From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The SAT exam is a rite of passage and peril for more than a million high school students each year. Today, the College Board voted to overhaul the exam. In this hour, the new SAT and what it says about American culture. We begin tonight with another hot-button education issue, school vouchers. The Supreme Court ruled today that school systems can issue vouchers that would support students attending private schools, including religious schools. While the court has issued its opinion, the nation remains divided on the issue and the impact of vouchers on public schools. Earlier, I asked Paul Peterson, director of the Program on Educational Policy and Governance at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, for his take on the Supreme Court ruling and the potential impact of a move to vouchers.
Well, of course, it's a landmark decision. It says that if parents are given a choice of the school they want their child to attend, and if secular schools are available as part of that choice, then a parent can choose a religious school and receive government support for that decision. It basically puts to rest the big constitutional question that's been hanging over school vouchers for some years.
You've looked at vouchers and voucher systems. How do they work? Do they take dollars away and quality away from public schools? And do they end up giving students who leave public schools a good education?
Well, actually, the best place to look at that is in Milwaukee, where you've had a voucher program for over 10 years, and you've had a fairly large one for the last 4 to 5 years. And what you find in Milwaukee is that the public schools there, their test scores are higher than they were before the voucher program began, especially in those schools impacted by the voucher program. So the public schools in Milwaukee have responded to the challenge.
In other words, it created competition and the schools improved as a result.
And the public schools improved as a result. It's really quite an interesting study, very carefully done by a Harvard economist. The other finding there is that public schools have more money per pupil than they had before because they have fewer students to teach. About 10% of them left went to voucher schools, but they still have money available for the remaining kids in larger amounts than they had previously on a per pupil basis. So it's pretty hard to say the public schools in Milwaukee have suffered. In fact, it's easier to make the claim that they prospered.
So you've looked at this for half a dozen years, and you don't buy the argument that allowing voucher students to go off to parochial schools or other schools will take dollars away from public schools and end up diminishing public school systems. You don't think the evidence bears that out?
Well, we always fund schools on a per pupil basis. That's the way it's always been done in the United States, so that if you move from one school district to another, the money follows you. And that's just the way it is here. The money follows the child. Now, not all of the money is following the child to those private schools. A little bit of it sticks behind, and that gives those kids in the public schools even more money per pupil than they had before. So it's pretty hard to make the claim the public schools are suffering. And some of them might not stand up to the challenge, but those in Milwaukee are. So it's up to the public schools to prove themselves, it would seem to me. Now, what we found in New York is that the test score gap for black Americans closes by about one half after 3 years. If a kid can get out of the public schools, go to private schools, their test scores go up by 3 to 4 grade levels over a 3-year period of time, which is a pretty big increase. And this is done with a randomized field trial, the kind you have in medical research. So we're pretty confident that at least for black kids, you're getting some real gains.
But that's when they leave public schools and go to a parochial school. Does that leave behind a gutted public school system for the students who remain there?
Well, the kids who go are pretty much a cross-section. We find very little in the way of the best and the brightest going to private schools. Why change schools if your kids are already doing well? So we see basically a cross-section of kids from a wide range of families taking advantage of the vouchers, and we see no signs of the public schools suffering. In fact, they're doing better in Milwaukee.
What about the Cleveland case that led to this Supreme Court decision? There we understand they've got one of the worst-rated public schools or school systems in the country, and people want it out. What have we seen, or what may we see? A flight from that school, a demise of that school or school system in favor of parochial schools?
Well, the voucher program there is capped at around 4,000 students, so you're not going to see a major impact on the public schools there. The impacts were bigger in Milwaukee, where you're getting 15% or more of the kids participating in the voucher program. But no, I'd say basically the impact on the Cleveland Public Schools is that they have more money, too, than they had before, but there's not all that much competition developing there because the program's been kept at a fairly low level. So unless the state ups the number of kids that can participate, there's probably not going to be that much competition in Cleveland.
Paul Peterson, from what you've seen, how widely across the country do you expect communities to begin to participate in this kind of voucher system? Will every major town and city have students taking vouchers in a decade and going off to private and parochial schools?
It's hard to forecast a decade out. I think it's going to go step by step. There'll probably be one or two more places. Florida is expanding its program this coming fall. We'll probably see one or two more states trying it out. There's going to be tremendous opposition in every state legislature because teacher unions are very much opposed to this.
But your bottom line is you believe we can both have a voucher program and have improved public schools. Is that correct?
Well, my position is education reform is badly needed in our big cities. We shouldn't rule anything off the table. Supreme Court has kept this reform on the table. That's a good thing. We should experiment. We should try other things, too.
Paul Peterson is the author of The Education Gap, Vouchers in Urban Schools, and a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. So, what did you get on the SAT? Admit it, you still remember the scores and the experience of taking the test. You can probably still see yourself back in high school, sweaty palms, clutching a number two pencil, praying to the test gods that the answer is B and not D. But criticism of the test as a measure of a student's potential has become widespread, and students' performance on the test can still make or break chances of getting into a top college. Today, the College Board unveiled a raft of changes in the SAT that include tougher math and a new writing section. Tonight, we're asking, what is the role of the SAT in American society? Does it level the playing field or level students who don't get the good scores? Is tinkering with the test the answer, or is it time to abolish the SAT? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York with his number two pencil poised and ready, we hope, is Gaston Caperton, president of the College Board. Good evening and welcome, Gaston Caperton.
Good evening.
Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
So, Gaston Caperton, changes today, and changes don't happen often in the SAT. What changes have been voted in today and why?
Well, the most important is the addition to writing to the SAT. If you think of the SAT as testing college success skills of math and English, and now you add writing, it's a very important thing for two reasons. Number one, it makes the test better able to analyze which students will be successful in college and how successful they'll be. And number two, we believe it will really encourage writing to become a more important part of the high school agenda. And we believe that writing is very important. Good writing is very important for college success and success beyond there.
You've also tweaked the math and verbal portions. How so?
Well, in the math, we have added we will add algebra 2 to strengthen what the math is. In the verbal part, first of all, we're going to get rid of analogies, which a lot of people have felt were something you didn't study in school, and people were a little too apt to use to learn those as a sort of a separate item outside of the curriculum, mm-hmm. outside of the standards, and it just didn't make good sense. And we've also renamed it, taken it from verbal and called it a reading, just so people understand critical reading, what we're talking about, so that people understand that these are really the success skills you need in college.
And how and when will the new changes be brought on stream?
The changes the first test that we will give that will show these changes will be in March of 2005.
Now, there's a critique out there that says, or at least a line of thinking, that these changes were carried out in response to a threat from the University of California system, obviously a very big one, and the first one historically to implement the SAT years ago, a threat to pull out, to stop using it, because I think they said it was warping what students were taught.
Well, first of all, remember the College Board is a nonprofit membership organization of which California is a very important member. So if we didn't listen to what our important member said, we'd be pretty stupid, and I hope we're not stupid. The research that we did in the change, we made major changes in the SAT in 1994. Some of the changes that we're making now are changes that were recommended there. I think that what California really did was to speed up the process and be a real catalyst for change for us. So I think that California will be pleased with what we've done, as the rest of the people around the country will. And the thing that's important to recognize is that this change was made as a national change in the SAT. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, California will decide that the changes we made are ones they like. They've said pretty soundly today they like what we're doing and think they'll join us.
Mm-hmm. Gaston Caperton, what was the original mission or purpose of the SAT supposed to be, and how do you see its role in American education and society today?
Well, if you go back to its very beginning, it was really the College Board was created by mainly the Ivy League schools that were all given their own individual admission test, and they said it doesn't make sense for each school to have their own test. Let's go together and build an organization that can create that test. The development of the SAT really occurred when the president of Harvard said, you know, we basically have the sons of Harvard coming to Harvard, and we know there's a lot of talented students across the country, and we need a test that gives us the opportunity to find those students wherever they might be, and we want a test that tests their reasoning and thinking skills, not just based upon who had the best education, but a chance to give a much broader view and a much better exposure to students, and it really has worked.
Jack Beatty, join us. You know that it was brought in to create a kind of meritocracy, but it's also been profoundly criticized as culturally biased and excluding people today.
Yeah, I went back today to check my intuitions about the SAT against a fine book on it by my former colleague Nick Lemon called The Big Test, The Secret History of American Meritocracy. And this is a thoroughgoing study of the Educational Testing Service, the SAT, and so on. And he concludes, really, that this enterprise has failed, that the original mission, which was to open equal opportunity for people who will otherwise not get to college, is being undermined. He writes, You can't undermine social rank by setting up an elaborate process of ranking. And he shows in detail how 50 years later, yes, we don't have the automatic admission of the son of Yale to Yale, but we have something else. We have the son of Yale, the new Yale student, chosen by merit, the merit documented by a test. The test not dependent upon what he learned in school, but upon, quote, innate ability, which we all know is just, you know, that merit is really luck and slow motion. It's the parents. It's the home. And secondly, that test is set up, can be gamed. You can get around it. So effectively, American a fair system would be a test that would be on achievement, on
Jack,
what
Jack,
you
I've just
learned
got a,
in college.
I've just got another minute with Gaston Caperton. Gaston Caperton, you have said yourself that the SAT is very fair.
I was on a panel with Nick Lemon about 3 weeks ago, in which he said the changes that we were making in the SAT, he felt were the changes that really needed to be made in order for it to be an effective test. He was very complimentary of what we're doing. And so I think that was what you're quoting is old news and not current news.
We've just got 20 seconds here. Let me quote you. You said the SAT is a very fair test, but there is an unequal education system in America.
That's correct.
A few seconds, but does the SAT perpetuate or abet that unfair education system?
I don't think so at all.
You think it's an equalizer? You think it actually works the other way?
Well, I think what it does is it is a test that predicts very effectively when you use it with grades and applications to college and the performance of students, it predicts very, very well which students are going to do well in college and which ones aren't. And so it has real validity there. The other thing about whether this is...
Gaston Caperton, I'm sorry, I've got to break in. I know you've got to go, and we thank you for joining us. We'll talk again. Gaston, thanks for being with us. Gaston Caperton is president of the College Board. We've got to take a quick break. We're talking about SATs. Do they work for America? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On a day when the SATs have been changed, have been revamped, we're asking, do the SATs work for America? Do they work for Americans? How do the SATs shape this country? Are the SATs a good way, a fair way, to sort the best and the brightest? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Claudio Sanchez. He's education reporter for National Public Radio. Claudio Sanchez, we're delighted to have you. Thanks for being on.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
I don't know if you heard that, but I just was forced to cut off the president of the College Board as he described the SATs. My kids are never going to college, Claudio Sanchez.
That's pretty risky, what you did there.
No choice, and I'm sorry for that to Gaston Caperton. Claudio Sanchez, you have watched the debate and listened to it over the SATs for years now. I hope you heard Gaston Caperton in his description of how the California university system has been a tough customer and seems to be satisfied with these new changes. But as you hear the critique of the SATs and the complaints about it, and the folks who are satisfied, what's the spectrum of views on this test?
Well, and I did hear Gaston Caperton and his comments. I guess, you know, the one issue I guess that kind of jumps up here is this notion that the SAT has somehow democratized college admissions. I mean, that's somewhat of a reach. What I hear really, and we did prepare a story on this leading up to this change, you know, what I hear really most often, especially from high school teachers, is that the SAT really doesn't reflect what, you know, high schools are teaching, what these kids are up against. And if you take something like writing in particular, I mean, it makes really the classic example, which is that high school kids these days are not learning how to write. They don't get time to write. They don't know how to write. They finish high school maybe with great grades, great GPAs, maybe even great SAT scores, but they are not writing, not nearly enough.
But does that mean we shouldn't be testing them on writing?
No, it doesn't. That's not. But again, that's not the point. I guess the larger question is the SAT the right tool with which to gauge good writing? Second, is it the right tool with which to admit students based on whatever writing skills these kids are exhibiting on what would be a pretty interesting 20 to 30 minute essay down the road. You know, the California system, when it did raise some of the very sticky questions about whether or not this was a useful tool, made it very clear that the biggest concern was that, as far as they were concerned, you know, the SAT, the verbal and math ability measured by the SAT, were traits really inculcated from very young ages in highly educated households, which impact really young children, rather than a measure of innate aptitude. In other words, there is really little evidence to show that high school kids who take the SAT are exhibiting anything other than what is going on outside of that classroom.
In other words, kind of cultural or environmentally instilled behavior. But that view almost seems to give up on the notion that we can bring American young people into schools and educate them to be literate and well-lettered.
Well, you know, the bottom line is that colleges of both selective as well as just typical, you know, public colleges in this country need a sorting tool of some sort, and this is really the next best thing. It's a necessary evil. Although I'll tell you, I mean, things have changed dramatically. In my trip to Florida in the last few weeks to do a story about this, the University of Florida, for example, can pick, you know, the 6,000 incoming freshmen next fall from the top 10% of the graduating classes of Florida high schools. It doesn't do that because it feels it would skew the kind of community that it wants to create. On the other hand, you know, it says, we don't think the SAT really tells us anything we don't already know by looking at kids' grades or the kind of high school they went to, whether these kids were challenging themselves with, you know, with honors courses, with tough courses. I mean, a lot of things that are going on in high school these days are suspect. And colleges have a really, really tough time figuring out who does deserve to come onto their campuses.
You mean suspect because some students are being coached and tutored in the SAT and others are not?
You name it. I mean, it can be an element one of the reasons is coaching. One of the other reasons is that, you know, high schools are so different. High schools run the gamut. You've got horrible high schools in, not just in Florida, but across the country that, you know, are essentially have a turnstile teaching core that comes in one year, leaves the other. You don't have honors courses. I think in California, in fact, over half of the high schools in the state, I believe, I don't know, don't quote me on this, but half of the high schools in the state don't offer honors courses or advanced placement courses. Now, where does that put them in terms of a disadvantage compared to the high school kids in other parts of the state that are getting an enormous amount of resources in order to make it, not just on the SAT, but in college and in general?
Jack Beatty, there's so much that converges here around the SAT. On the one hand, you could make the argument that, hey, why not have a test? It's supposed to measure how well prepared they are for their freshman year of college. If they can't write, they're not as well prepared. On the other side, what Claudio Sanchez is pointing to is inequities in American education, which is the opportunity. There's merit versus opportunity here, perhaps. Boy, this has got a lot of weight on one test.
It does. And, you know, who elected the SAT? Who elected ETS? This is an educational, you know, he says, Grasso Caperton says, a private organization. Well, sure. But it's now become the gatekeeper of American life. Much of what young people do is all built around passing this big, decisive test. Now, its nationalizing functions are important, but that's not the only way you could get a national measure. For example, if a test were given on a national, if we had a national high school curriculum, which we have long needed, every other nation has it, we could have a national test on what children learned. Mm-hmm. Now, what would that test? That would test effort. That would test discipline. That would test willpower. That would test study habits. It would not test this amorphous, vague thing called aptitude, which often can just simply be a kind of class privilege put in numbers and psychometric tests. And it wouldn't have this cynical aspect of, you know, you can game the system. You can get around it through these trot tests and Princeton Review and so on. And maybe with a system like that, we would get different leaders. For example, what did we see on September 11th? Well, I know one thing I saw. CBS did that documentary that showed the French filmmakers, you know, at the firehouse. We all talked about that. Well, in the scene there where the building falls down, the Frenchman's running for his life. He dives under a car to save his life, and he feels something come down on top of him. And then all the debris comes down, and he wonders, what's this? Well, it was the fire chief. The guy was falling on him to save his life. What we want as a society is a system that will get a man with those qualities to the top, not Jeff Skilling. We want a man like that. That's character. That's leadership. That's what we need to honor in our society. And these tests don't even begin to touch that.
Claudio Sanchez, that would take a cosmic test indeed to measure that kind of moral fiber. But we do know currently, I think, 1.3 million American kids take the test at least once every year. Do you have a sense of what portion of them are being coached now and how big an issue is that? Does it bias the test against uncoached people?
Well, you know, I don't have the figures on how many kids are taking the coaching. And remember, I mean, when I was down in Gainesville, Florida, I heard that sixth graders were getting coached. I mean, we're taking the Kaplan course on the SATs, the PSATs, the SAT-2. I mean, this is a huge industry, clearly, and there's a lot of money to be made from coaching.
And then these coaching courses are expensive. I read here they're $700-$800 per course.
That's right. And the writing test, I mean, it's a real boom for, you know, it's going to represent a real boom for Kaplan and Princeton and a bunch of outfits like that. Now, you know, I did want to bring this back to something that I guess hasn't been thrown into this conversation, and that is the I guess on the somewhat of a related issue, and that is, you know, if we're all looking for ways to really reward hard work and great character and you know, the effort that kids put into their schooling, there is a 10 to 15 year school reform effort in this country that maybe one would argue has not yielded as much as we would like, but it is there nonetheless. I mean, you've got states these days working towards, again, with all its flaws, standardized tests, trying to measure or gauge to some degree objectively, you know, what these kids should know and be able to do by the time they graduate from high school or at different critical stages in their schooling.
This gets to Jack Beatty's suggestion of a national high school curriculum that could be objectively tested and graded?
That's right. You got it. I mean, this is the one thing that everybody is so scared of. Somehow, the view that we're going to centralize education and education standards to the degree to which the federal government or someone in Washington is going to be dictating to kids, you know, what they should be learning, or to school boards, God forbid, you know, what they should be teaching. I think that this is we're coming to a point where I think this discussion is going to really build a head of steam. And I think the SAT, whether it knows it or not, is helping, you know, push that issue along. I think clearly the SATs, and I think to be fair to the SATs, I mean, they're not the only ones that get blasted for creating this gateway or becoming the gatekeeper of, you know, of success or of opportunity in this country. There's the huge ACT test, which, you know, in many ways is different. It may reflect high school curriculum a little bit more, but it's still a gatekeeper. I mean, this society is really crazy about testing, about credentialing people. And there have been commissions, back to the mid-'80s that have said, we don't need these kinds of gateways. We don't need these kinds of litmus tests or testing and standardized testing to really reward people for the hard work they put into things. And I guess that's the question, the fundamental question that we need to ask ourselves. And it's not just in schools. It's not just in as far as putting the college board on the defensive.
Mm-hmm.
It really is a societal issue. I mean, the same people who criticize often the SATs are the same ones who would, on the other hand, pick up the newspaper and see whether their real estate values have gone down because the SATs are lower.
We do want a way to measure so that it's not just privilege and connections, but what should that be? Claudio Sanchez, Jack Beatty, stand by. A lot of callers want to come in here. Kevin's on the line. Welcome, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes. It's the idea of privilege and socioeconomic background, its relationship to the test.
Mm-hmm.
There's a discrepancy between, let's say, parental income and, let's say, test scores.
Is it a discrepancy or a connection?
Well, there's a very, very, very strong correlation between the two, but it's not a perfect correlation. And that's necessary because that rationalizes the relationship between privilege and educational access.
So, Kevin, are you then gung-ho for the SAT, or you're saying it warps opportunity against the less high-income children from less high-income families?
What it does, it gives it's not a perfect okay, here's the thing. Socioeconomic background, parental income has a much, much stronger correlation to educational opportunity than any test.
So is that fair, unfair? How should we be measuring? How should we be deciding?
Well, the test actually counters slightly socioeconomic background, but only slightly. But by countering it, it legitimizes it. The thing is, with the same particular test score, you'll find out that there's a direct relationship, even with people at the same test score, that there's a strong, strong relationship between parental income and actual educational opportunity.
Well, that's
independent
of
the test.
Mm-hmm.
But by the test being somehow has an independent effect slightly, it gives the appearance that our discrepancies that are overwhelmingly based on socioeconomic criteria are somehow legitimized.
Right. Kevin, you're leaving us. I see both sides, and it's leaving us right on the fence, and it's a little bit of a painful position. But thanks for calling. Bill Hiss is joining us now. He's Vice President for External and Alumni Affairs and former Dean of Admissions at Bates College in Lewiston, Maine. Good evening, and welcome, Bill Hiss.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Bill Hiss, Bates College does not require the SAT. As I understand it, there are several hundred colleges that do now not necessarily make it a requirement for the admissions or application. How did Bates come to the decision not to require SAT scores from its applicants?
We have not required SATs for the last 17 years, since 1984. And every year, about a quarter of our students come to Bates with no testing submitted. The patterns have been absolutely consistent for all 17 years of the policy. The students get exactly the same grades. The difference between submitters and non-submitters over the whole 17-year history of the policy is 0.04 of a GPA point.
So the evidence is in at Bates College that you don't need the SATs to figure out who will do well in college. Do you think, does that suggest that we could or should just jettison them nationally?
I'm not sure, but I have moved to the left on this issue over time.
And what is the left on this issue?
I used to say every college has to do their own research. Bates did its research. Harvard has to do its. The University of California.
Mm-hmm.
I think watching what has happened nationally to access issues has moved me to the left. Jean Garcia, the dean of education at Cal, wrote a fascinating paper a few years back where he pointed out that about 50% of the K-12 youngsters in California were Latino, and the admit rate for those youngsters to the University of California system was 2 to 4%. That simply did not pass the laugh test for me as social policy, and
so,
I'm not
Bill,
pointing the finger at California. I think
so you're saying let's move away from the SAT and move to other measures, and not just measures of aptitude, but to other social indicators to get a cross-section of society into our universities? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Let multiple lights get on, and don't assume you're all going to measure all young people with the lights set at the same intensity. That's the danger of any standardized test system. I think the changes the College Board is making, probably on the whole, are positive. But when we find that for 25% of the students, none of the tests are predictive. It's not whether we have three tests or two, or in the case of SAT-2s, they have now six tests instead of five. None of the tests are predictive, and we would say let those students tell us what they are very, very good at doing. And the history, our history at Bates has been when those students say, I am a better student than these tests would suggest, they're correct.
Well, there you have it. Bill Hiss, thank you for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Bill Hiss is Vice President for External and Alumni Affairs at Bates College in Lewiston, Maine. Claudio Sanchez, there you hear at Bates College and others have Bates for years now and others more recently have begun not requiring the test. They have a more, I guess, holistic approach to assessing applicants. Is this a catching thing? Are the SATs sliding off the table, or are Americans fundamentally, addicted to having that kind of number measurement?
Well, the SATs are falling off the table. The issue is, though, is how quickly. There are over 300 colleges and universities, including Bates, that have dropped the SAT, or at least not required, or not no longer requiring it. And I don't know if Bill Hiss is still there, but we did a story about the admissions process up at Bates, and one of the fascinating things about that process, of course, is that this is extraordinarily individualized admissions process. They sit down with the prospective student, their parents, they talk at length, for at least an hour about their background besides having read their essays, looked at this very intricate, just record of academic performance. And I don't think that Ann Arbor, Michigan, the University of Michigan, or the University of Arizona, or any school over
20,000 students
is going to be able to do that. I think it works for Bates because it's small, because it takes enormous care in selecting its students. On the other hand, I did see, and of course this has been years ago, but I know that Bates gets the kinds of students that are just blue chippers, as they say. These are kids. Academic standards at Bates are tough. They expect kids to work hard there. And I think that the kind of kids they get or attract anyway are precisely those kids.
Claudio Sanchez, we have to take a short break, but we'll be right back. Do we need the SATs? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the SATs. They've been revamped in a major way that will be rolled out in the year 2005. A new essay section will be added, and the perfect score will no longer be 1,600. It will be 2,400. But do we need the SATs? What did your SAT scores say about you? Something important or not? Should SATs be a key piece of the college admissions process? Would it be chaos without them? And I guess, finally, can there be one test for multicultural America? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. 423 Talk. We're happy to be joined tonight by Claudio Sanchez, education reporter for National Public Radio, and right now by Ray on the line. Welcome, Ray. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I had an issue with something Jack Beatty said, that people from poor families or uneducated families go to school or are unable to get good grades. And then the SATs also weighed in on this and kind of perpetuated our ability to get into college.
What's your view, Ray?
Well, I was uneducated, or came from an uneducated family.
Okay.
And a very poor family, and they had no idea how to direct me to, by the time I finished high school, to get myself into college.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I finished high school, I was really lost, had no idea what was going on. And it was the SATs that saved me.
How so? You got great scores and off you went?
Yes. I had a 1.8 GPA
mm-hmm.
and didn't even have a chance to get into a California school. The next state over, the University of Arizona, has an and/or clause. If you don't meet a certain GPA, if you have a decent SAT score, you can get in.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my savior. I was able to see other people at the University of Arizona that were in the same position.
It's an important story to be reminded of. Stick with us, Ray. Jack Beatty, how about it? Ray reminds us that the SATs can also be a life ring for folks like himself who've got an ability that shines in the test but didn't shine in school.
This was just what the original founders of the test wanted. They wanted people to select people like Ray who deserve a second chance and whose ability can be manifested in that. But also, I think this is just the kind of example that strengthens the point Kevin made earlier. This legitimizes this very valid and moving and important example of a person's merit showing through thanks to this test. It legitimates a test that says that that really picks the elite in society by how well they do at school, when we know there are many more qualities that go into leadership than just simply how well you did in school.
So, I'm sorry, Jack.
No, go ahead.
Ray, give us your advice, and what should we do here? You know that it cuts against some people. It cut in your direction. How should we handle this test?
Things seem to be pretty good as is. When you guys mentioned that all these high school kids are taking this test and their whole careers are on the line because of this test, that doesn't appear to be true because so many universities have so many different criteria. There are some schools that say you have to have excellent GPA, excellent SAT scores, and other schools really don't consider – they do consider this, but they consider all the other extracurriculars and so on, all the character – other things that may indicate character, like Jack Beatty said, was important.
Mm-hmm. All those elements. Ray, congratulations on your good luck. Claudio Sanchez, what about the relative importance of the SAT and the way colleges look at kids? You noted earlier that some universities, many are so large they can't get down to long, long interviews with each student. But are the SATs diminishing in their weight in the application package?
They are, but, you know, more often than not, what you've got, and I'll give you the example of, let's say, the University of Maryland, College Park here, right outside Washington, it's almost a given that in order to get into that school, because, you know, it's a good deal. You get, certainly if you're in-state, you want to go there. There's great professors, good quality, and so it's very competitive. Now, the university can't help but look at SAT scores, and it says, look, we're going to start looking really from the 1200s on up.
It just makes our job easier, windows down the field.
That's right. Now, I may get some calls tomorrow about this, but I mean, they most schools don't admit it, but they do look at those scores and they say, we want diversity, we want, just a range of experiences here from all kinds of kids, from all kinds of places, but in the end, the numbers count. And there's really, I see no evidence anyway that schools are going to get away from that.
Mary's on the line. Welcome, Mary. You're on the air.
I just wanted to make a comment about stressing the writing aspect of the entrance testing.
Which is the piece that will be added in a couple of years, we hear today.
Yes. I am a product of, actually, ironically, the Cleveland school system.
Okay. You've got vouchers, you've got SATs, you've got everything today.
Everything. But I always did well as a student, and I couldn't break 1,000 on the SAT, but I was always trained as a very good writer. And so I think basically my writing skills got me an academic scholarship into a private college. And I'm just wondering why they don't just have more of an essay format and, like, scrap the test. But, in terms of admissions, really stress that essay, that personal statement, that, you know, really being able to communicate what kind of student you are and what your activities have been.
Let's put it to Claudio Sanchez. Claudio, I guess they're trying to test a range of things. Mary is welcoming the fact that there's an essay here. Are people anticipating that this will advantage a different kind of student?
Well, you know, the fact is that I'd say that at least three-quarters of most public colleges and universities and private institutions are already asking kids to write something. I mean, they do require some kind of essay, some kind of written sample of what their views of life is.
But, of course, you can be coached on that or even have somebody else write it for you,
I suppose. And that's one of the things, of course, that the SAT change purports to deal with. I mean, it's a controlled setting in which you got a deadline, and there's no, you know, uncle or mom or dad to help you there.
Claudia, what kind of questions are going to be there, and do you know how they're going to grade these essays?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I don't know if Governor Caperton had, you know, answered this question. I'm sure he touched on it at this today's news conference. But I mean, there's still some debate as to whether this should be graded by computers. What I've heard is that they may have as many as three people read these essays. If they disagree, you know, somebody will chime in there and say, look, here's the score we should give this person. That is going to be, I think that's why they need to introduce these in 2005. I mean, it's going to be very hard between now and 2005 to really come up with something that's credible. And people have said all along, you know, how do you really evaluate good writing? I mean, it's really a very subjective process in many regards. So I think they're going to have to resort to, I guess, what we all would consider at least the most basic skills that you need to write well in college and to write well for the rest of your life.
And that would have advantaged Mary. Mary, thank you for your call. I'm wondering, though, if that also, to grade that many essays, means that the grading will have to be somehow formulaic, which means the writing can be formulaic, which means the same coaching companies can come in and coach folks on that test, Claudio.
That's correct. I mean, you know, when I sat through some of the Kaplan instruction that right down the street from the University of Florida, I mean, the folks there who have been gearing up for this for months, if not years, say, look, we know exactly what those graders are expecting, what they're going to be looking for, and we're going to be teaching it. Whether it's sentence structure, vocabulary, grammar, organization of thought, we're going to drill these kids with that kind of experience, and we're going to prepare them. And I think they're going to go in there confident. I guess half of this, the Kaplan folks have always argued that half of the battle in going into an SAT exam is going in there confident. I mean, if you freeze, forget it. You're just not going to make it.
That doesn't work. Christina's on the line. Welcome, Christina. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling from Fair Test, which is an organization in Cambridge. And I also want to just quickly point out this growing list of more than 300 schools that don't require test scores is actually on our website at fairtest.org, in case listeners want to look that up.
And Fair Test is pro or anti SATs, Christina?
We are critical of the SAT, and we actually encourage the University of California and all the other colleges and universities in this country to really look with skepticism on these revisions to the test.
Our time is ticking down, but what's your critique, basic critique of the test and these revisions?
Well, the revisions don't address any of the fundamental flaws with the SAT that have been there all along that the University of California actually has pointed out.
In your mind?
The exam isn't a very good predictor of college performance. It's coachable. It's not very tied to classroom learning. And none of these revisions will really address those fundamental flaws.
So can it be fixed, or do you urge that it be thrown out?
Well, I think Bill Hiss and Bates College lead the way in showing us a better admissions process that is test score optional.
Test score optional.
That's right.
And perhaps that's what we'll catch on. Christina, thank you for your call. Jack Beatty, here we are looking. It's easy to get down into the mechanics and details of this test, but this bigger question of whether or not America is a meritocracy, whether it can be, whether there is one test for this multicultural country, keeps floating through the conversation.
It does. And you know, we're a plural nation. We have many different cultures and strands that make us up, and we recognize that as our strengths in some ways. And yet when it comes to these standardized tests, we say, no, there's only one way. And I'm just really worried about what's happened with leadership in our country. I know this is a field, but I do think we have a crisis here. We see it in business. You can bet that Skilling and all the rest of them did very well on their SATs.
The Enron CEO.
you can be sure of it. And, you know, again, I think you've got to select. If there has to be a way to select for things like determination, you know, character, the willingness to put in the time. Those things that often get scorned as the grind virtues, those are the virtues that holds a society together and that makes it work. And we need a system that promotes those. And I fear that this system does not do that, and that many people fall by the wayside who otherwise could advance in life.
Claudio Sanchez, we've just got 15 seconds, but your prediction, will the SAT maintain its position in the center of American testing?
I think we won't know until that test is ready. As we speak, though, the SAT is obviously on the defensive, and I think that nothing's really going to change to change that. My only other comment is about Jake Beatty. Jake Beatty, I think, sets a very, very high standard. I mean, if we had a tool to measure human potential, somebody would have invented it by now.
Claudio, we're all about high standards here at On Point. Thank you very much for joining us tonight, Claudio Sanchez.
You're welcome.
Claudio Sanchez is education reporter for National Public Radio. And Jack Beatty, thank you for being with us for this hour and for your high standards.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, testing your college party IQ. This is On Point. Thanks to today's decision by the College Board, the SAT that you and I know and love is going through some changes. WBUR's Walter Dixon thinks that change is just what the exam needs, but he has his own idea of how to test whether students are ready for college life.
The following is an SAT exam designed to test your capacity to function in the real world of college. Question 1. You are the first to arrive at your freshman dorm room and find there are exactly 2.5 square meters of personal living space to be shared with your three roommates. Using only a sheet of paper, how would you resolve this problem? A. Draw a grid of the room and allocate space evenly between the four of you. B. Make a sign that says, "Mine," and claim the space with a pile of laundry. C. Shred the paper to confetti and celebrate. You obviously got the biggest room in the dorm. Question 2. If a plain campus cheeseburger on a bun is 12% grains and 10% cheese, the remainder is A, 75% all-American beef, B, 70% all-American beef and soy, C, 78% all-American seeds, genuine animal meat product, and dust. Question 3. Tim is throwing a party. He has a pressurized aluminum container, which holds exactly 15.5 gallons of a cold, foamy beverage. He has 10 friends, each of whom will consume at least 1 liter of said beverage per half hour for 6 hours. Does Tim have enough cold, foamy beverage? A. Yes, because the math shows there will be plenty left over. B. Yes, because his friends will pass out before consuming their maximum capacity. C. No, because anyone who thinks only 10 friends will show up for a kegger is a moron. Question 4. Consider the following quote from 19th century author Lamon Blanchard.
Give me to live with love alone, and let the world go dine and dress.
Which statement most closely reflects what Blanchard was saying? A. Nothing else matters when true love is yours. B. Don't be afraid to kick out your roommates for the night when you are bringing back a date. C. Chicks love quotations. Question 5. Tim has 17 hours of schoolwork to complete and deliver to class in exactly 24 hours. He lives 20 minutes from class. He is hungry and needs to sleep before he can work. He should A. Sleep for 6 hours, eat for 20 minutes, and study with 3 5-minute breaks. B. Sleep for 7.5 hours and study while eating with no breaks. C. Think twice next time before throwing a kegger on the week of finals. This concludes our SAT exam, studying your capacity to function in the real world of college.
Walter Dixon is On Point's resident career counselor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.